This is NPR News. I'm Mike Edgerly in this hour for Carrie Miller. When I hopped on my bike for the ride into the studio this morning, the sun was rising, trees changing color, and the temperature was about 45 degrees. In some parts of the continental U.S., a 45-degree morning would be anything but a good time for a ride. But in these parts, this really is a sign that the best time of the year is upon us, and not just for riding, but anything outdoors. If there's a problem with our beautiful autumns, there's just not enough time to do everything outside and still manage to do stuff like, you know, earn a living. Our guest this hour will help us sort through this quandary and help us make some decisions about where to go, what to do, and maybe some of the equipment we need to use to do that. Stephen Reginald is the Minneapolis-based founder and editor of Gear Junkie, one of the most popular online outdoor adventure and gear websites and newsletters around. Stephen, welcome back to NPR.
Hey, Mike. Good to be here.
And we'd like to hear from you, too. Call with your questions for Stephen, the Gear Junkie, at 800-242-2828, 800-242-2828, or 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. You can also tweet me at on NPR News. And joining us this morning in the studio is NPR's Michael Olson. He's monitoring the conversation online at nprnews.org/live. Stephen, what is your favorite season for camping, running, riding, climbing, paddling?
We are at that optimal state right now where you can push yourself in the outdoors and barely break a sweat. So I love this kind of shoulder season between summer and fall. Wore the gloves this morning for the first time. Did you wear gloves?
I had to, yeah.
First day of the year for the bike gloves. So love this time of year for sure.
Right. It's kind of amazing, isn't it, that we have just about this perfect combination of good warm sun, cool temperatures, perfect humidity,
and
it's just incredible, right? And then the view is there as well.
Crispy fall morning, sunrise, yeah, it just really doesn't get much better.
You built the Gear Junkie for people like me. You know, I like to see what the latest in gear is. But your life has revolved around training and outdoor adventure since you began with your climbing zine when you were at the U of M, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Yeah, I've been into this forever since I was a little kid, and just kind of combined my passion for the outdoors with my career, my job as a journalist, and built this Gear Junkie thing. Started with Vertical Jones, the climbing magazine that you mentioned back in 1997. So been at it for a bit.
How has the Gear Junkie and your outdoor life, how have they changed since those days when you started that climbing magazine?
Honestly, with job, children, and just, you know, maturing and getting into my career, it's been more compressed in that a lot of my adventures now are in the cities and even in the city, just in Minneapolis. So not getting out every Saturday to climb up on the North Shore anymore, but climbing with my kids or finding adventure here, and then also getting out of town and still maintaining the adventure circuit when I can.
Yeah. Now, do you do adventure races? You've done some of that in the past, right?
Yeah, I'm a big endurance sports guy, big adventure race guy. This year, I actually got pretty heavily back into climbing. I did four big trips. So I hit Yosemite a couple weeks ago, actually, Mount Blanc over in France, Highlight Canyon, and then also climbed in Mount St. Helens out in Washington State. So jumping back into the climbing game a little bit.
Right. Now, some of those names are familiar to people who follow climbing in the outdoors. Now, Highlight is outside of Bozeman, I believe. And who were you climbing with?
Famous mountaineer Conrad Anker. And he and I actually go back to the Vertical Jones days, again, the climbing zine, and met him, you know, two decades ago and just have kept in contact, watch his career and his mountaineering feats just bloom, and reconnected with him last spring to do some ice climbing. An incredible guy.
So let's move on to talk a little bit about some gear, and you've been writing about some of this in your new newsletter. And one thing that surprised me was this idea of elevated tents. Now,
yeah.
I long to sleep on the hard ground. It feels great, and I'd never sleep better than when I'm on a thermarest somewhere. But Yakima and some other, the rack companies are getting into this now of putting us on top of our vehicles.
Right. It's sort of a Australia, New Zealand thing, African safari thing that's now coming to the U.S. So it's essentially a tent mounted on your vehicle, whether that's a car or a truck. And the big news as of late was Yakima, the big rack behemoth brand, is launching a rooftop tent for 2017. So that's bringing it into the mainstream. There's been niche brands doing it, and then internationally it's a little bit bigger, but it's becoming mainstream. One of our editors lived out of a rooftop tent for multiple weeks this summer, road tripping to Alaska. So he kind of validated it for our organization too.
So how does this work? I mean, I'm a restless sleeper, and if I roll, I'm going to hit the ground, right?
You zip it up, so you hopefully won't roll out, Mike. But yeah, it's a tent literally on a platform 6 feet off the ground. So you climb in with the ladder, pull the ladder up if you want, zip it up and have this kind of vantage. And it's just kind of this all-contained, almost pseudo-RV kind of a thing. You get to a site, pop it up, go to sleep. It's just this self-contained unit.
Right, and I guess it does prevent some problems with drainage. If you put your tent in the wrong place, you get soaked, and this keeps you up off the ground and maybe out of the snow and stuff
like
that.
It's kind of quirky here and just kind of fun. I think it's more utilitarian in places where there are lions and dangerous things roaming around. Hopefully that's not a concern in Minnesota, but people are jumping into it a little bit.
Right. You can call us with your question or comment at 651-227-6000 or toll free 800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828, and online at nprnews.org/live. Stephen Reginald, the Gear Junkie, is our guest in this hour. What else are you seeing out there, Stephen, that we should know about?
Well, we just covered a big bike show, Interbike, so lots of innovations in the bike world. And a big trend is bike packing. So instead of backpacking, it's bike packing. There's all these brands developing packs and racks and bikes and accessories for traveling into the backcountry and toting your gear along with you. So it's a twist on bike touring. Bike touring is essentially using panniers and hitting long distances on roads. This is putting it on a mountain bike, getting on trails, and literally doing what you would do when you're backpacking, but on a bike. So That was a major trend, and it continues to be. There's all sorts of more tech-oriented things. I rode around the city a couple nights ago with laser beams following me on my bike. So it was creating this virtual bike lane.
Yeah.
Lasers shooting off from underneath the bike saddle. And, I think the drivers in the cars saw me a little bit better. So kind of two extremes, the getting back to nature on one side with cycling and then more the tech stuff.
Right.
We're looking at a helmet right now that has a bone conductor technology. Instead of earbuds, these two pods kind of interface with your cheekbones and send sound waves through your head. And it kind of works. It's kind of crazy.
It kind of works to do what?
It allows you to hear the ambient noises of traffic and so forth, while also getting the audio or taking a phone call. So strange solution, but one of those pieces of tech that I'm into.
Right. That's interesting. There is that line, isn't there, between having fun in the outdoors and tools and sort of fun stuff and maybe becoming a little overburdened by our gear, right?
Yep.
I mean, talking about bike camping and bike overnighting off a bike. I see a lot of people in the East Metro. It looks like they're heading to the state parks along the St. Croix, and they're tents and pads, and they're just traveling with their regular bikes, maybe pulling a trailer or something like that, or maybe with a couple of panniers.
I mean, sure. You can throw your tent and even like a burley or something and do that, and that works on a paved trail. Once you actually want to hit single track and go deep into the backcountry, you're probably going to want to get specialized gear. But yeah, it's you can go overboard and get too far into the gear, the tech, or you can really use it to just get out there and really enjoy things.
Right. We've gotten some questions from our Public Insight Network. Let's just pick one here. Avi writes, what do I need for a good winter commuter bike? What's the best way to clean it? She has a Avi has a friend who's gone through two bikes in as many years due to rust and crud from Minnesota roads.
Yeah, I've written extensively on that and am a big winter commuter. And I guess my current philosophy is try to get as many components off your bike as possible. So I ride single speed in the winter. I ride fixed gear. And, you know, I have a fender on back and that's about it. So all the gears and derailleurs and, you know, if you, brakes are usually necessary, but a fixed gear allows you to usually just run a front brake. If you can really skim back on what's on your bike, it's going to just declutter it. It doesn't get filled with sand and grit, and it's easier to clean. It's also a cheaper solution, and you know, a lot of people I know use a quote-unquote junker bike all winter, and I do too. It's just, it's hard to keep a bike, you know, rust-free after months of abusing it in the winter.
Right.
One tip that I always tell people is keep your bike cold. Don't bring it in and out of office buildings or a heated garage all winter long. That freeze thaw that it's subjected to can really sort of perpetuate the harm done. So I just keep my bike cold all winter. I park it outside at the office, and then at home it's in a non-heated garage, and it's kind of icy all winter, but it seems to do something.
Right. Let's go to the phones. Christine in Isanti, you're on with Steve and Reginald.
Hi. I just have a strange question. We've camped in the fall every year down around Wabasha, and we've always rented a camper because it's cold. Well, this year, just due to finances, and we can't take the camper, but we have a tent we use in the summer. Is there anything you can tell me that would help with the cold as far as camping with a tent in the fall where you go over MEA break?
Yeah, the main thing is keeping yourself insulated from the ground. And I think that's what some people miss is they use their thinner summer weight pads in the winter or the fall. And the ground is really cold and it'll seep up through your body. So maybe an extra piece of EVA foam pad that are really cheap, you know, they're $10 or $15, will just add that insulation from underneath. And then double up the sleeping bags, wear a hat to bed, and there's not a whole lot more to it than that. You know, I've camped in 30 below zero with that kind of setup, and as long as you, and I have used two sleeping bags, so sometimes you just got to double it up. If you don't want to drop the big money on a 20 below bag, you can, especially if you're car camping, just bring more sleeping bags, bring some blankets.
Right. If you're car camping, you can bring anything, right?
Exactly. Get your head covered up, wear a hat, and you should be okay.
You can join our conversation with Stephen at 651-227-6000 or toll-free 800-242-2828 and online this morning at nprnews.org/live. We have a question, Stephen, from Lindsay. It also has to do with winter conditions. Her daughter will be 6 months old this winter, and she'd like to get her out for more than just a quick walk. What do you recommend? How did you dress your kids when you were introducing them to winter outdoors?
Yeah, we just put them in the one-piece little kids suits where they have zero dexterity, really, and almost no movement. It's almost like a wearable sleeping bag, and then keep them close to your body. So my wife and I have used these slings that just keep the baby right next to your chest, or these soft side kid backpacks where the kid is really just kind of pressing against your body as opposed to the rigid frame where they have kind of a layer between you. So, and then when they get a little older, I mean, kids have a usually fast, high metabolism and they don't get cold. I mean, it depends on the kid, but my kids are generally really good in the cold and they're running around. So once they're a little bit older, they're pretty self-sufficient out there. When they're little, yeah, just bundle them up and get them close to you.
Mm-hmm. Going from winter and back to cycling, we have a question. Where are the best places to ride fat bikes in Minnesota, and what kind of conditions are best for that kind of riding?
So fat bikes have become kind of a year-round sport, and initially it was very much winter-oriented. So in the winter, there are some of the big iconic events like the Arrowhead 135, the Tuscobia, up in Winnipeg, there's a big winter ultra race. But, you know, you can, most of the mountain biking trails, or I should say a lot of the mountain biking trails now are packed out for winter riding with fat bikes, including a lot of the places in the Twin Cities and places like Cuyuna are really focusing on that. Some areas are even grooming their trails for fat bikes. So that's becoming more and more of a thing. Either ski areas at Spirit Mountain, they offer lift-accessed fat biking. So you can take a chairlift up and ride a bike down the ski slope.
Slalom on your bike.
Crazy enough. So look out for the fat bikers when you're skiing this winter.
Right. Do you fat bike? Do you ride the big tires?
I do. I've done the Arrowhead race, about one of the first editions, and we have a fat bike in the office that we kind of kick around, and every year we do several rides for sure. I don't ride it as my daily commuter, though.
Mm-hmm. Do you ride with stud tires?
Winter? I do ride with studs for my daily commuter. Mm-hmm. That's my goal, my strategy.
Tell us a little bit about some of the other gear that you've been looking at. I noticed that drones are seem to be booming now, and GoPro has released its own drone to go with its new edition of its very popular GoPro series.
That was a big deal. So GoPro, the action camera behemoth, came out with a drone finally, and they introduced it in kind of this Apple computer-like unveiling with a dark stage and demos, and it's cool. It's just kind of an evolution of what a drone is. It's easier to use. It flies a little faster than some of the competition. Its camera also removes out of the drone and is on a gimbal, so you can use it as a stabilized motion camera when it's not flying around. There are other drones now that will follow you and film you. So that's a big deal for if you're into capturing your own action going down the ski slope. Set this thing up and it tracks you wirelessly via GPS where you are. It has object avoidance technology to not run into a lift tower, hopefully. And it films you as you go down the slope. So that's a crazy thing.
It's crazy. You know, I take cameras when I go out. I always take a GoPro and on a point, nice point and shoot. But I got to say, having a drone following me as I make my way through the woods.
A little creepy.
It's starting to get a little weird.
Yeah, it's a bit over the top. We've used drones on a bunch of film projects, and they just give you an amazing helicopter-like view, and I love them, but you can certainly overdo it.
Yeah. Michael Olson, you have something for us?
Yeah, you thought that black flies were, your big enemy out there. Here come the drones. There are a couple questions about winter camping. Folks that that seem to be somewhat experienced campers in the soft water months and warmer months, but wondering about any suggestions on how to make the transition to winter camping.
A lot of the gear can go from summer or fall camping to winter camping. It's more of a maybe mindset and a technique, and it depends what you mean by winter camping. Are you going to go build a snow cave or a Quinsy? Are you going to do a warm tent with a stove? Or are you going to go set up your tent at a state park site with your car nearby? So I think it's just a lot about embracing it, reading up on sort of some basic do's and don'ts, but it's not as crazy as you think. The days are short and the nights are long and cold, so it's just a different experience. And depending on what it is, I've just felt in survival mode for winter camping at times, and then other times just kind of in this bliss of the beautiful winter woods, nobody's around. And so kind of embracing the mindset, there's a million things with gear, but really the main thing is the sleeping, because you're just stationary laying on the ground in the snow for hours. And as I said earlier, it's kind of insulating from below and just having the right kind of sleeping bag system.
Right. And part of it is the time of year and when how we as humans have adapted, right? I mean, it seems really cold in December when it's, you know, just 25 degrees or so. Whereas in late February, after we've had 2 or 3 months of getting accustomed to it and riding all winter, you know, you go out and it's really, it's just a light jacket, you know, when it's that.
I do want to know the physiology behind that. Is it actually
it's up here between our ears?
Exactly.
Is it
psychological, or is it something happened to your blood vessels on the surface of your skin? Or it's actually a story I want to pursue because it's such a strange phenomenon.
But it is a thing, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, in March, 40 degrees feels like 75 degrees. It's just ridiculous.
Well, I know in my case, I put on a lot of weight over the winter. So that's physical.
Yeah.
And maybe connected to my mental problems, too. Anyway, our guest this hour is Stephen Reginald. He's editor and founder of Gear Junkie. You can join our conversation, and we'll continue with him after a look at the news.
Good morning from Minnesota Public Radio News. I'm Mike Moen. Forecasters say the first outer rain bands from Hurricane Matthew already have begun to approach Florida as the big storm crosses the Bahamas. It's still a Category 3 hurricane, packing top sustained winds of 125 miles an hour. However, Matthew is expected to become an even more powerful Category 4 storm in the coming hours as it approaches Florida's east coast starting tonight. Meanwhile, city officials in Charleston, South Carolina, say the city has run out of sandbags after distributing more than for any other storm. There were long lines of motorists waiting to get sandbags at one distribution point on the city's north side late yesterday. The storm is already being blamed for at least 16 deaths in the Caribbean. A Turkish official says at least 5 people have been hurt after a bomb placed on a motorcycle exploded near a police station in Istanbul. Turkey has been rocked by a wave of deadly bomb attacks in the past year carried out by Kurdish rebels or Islamic State militant groups. The number of Americans seeking unemployment benefits fell last week. The Labor Department says weekly applications for jobless aid slid by 5,000 to a seasonally adjusted 249,000. The less volatile 4-week average dropped to its lowest level since December 1973. Meanwhile, healthcare and real estate stocks are leading an early decline on Wall Street as the market gives back some of a gain from the day before. Right now in the Twin Cities, it's 50 degrees under sunny skies. More news ahead on Minnesota Public Radio News. It's 9:42.
Hi, I'm Chris Farrell. Join me for the next Conversations on the Creative Economy on October 14th with Joanne Jenkins, CEO of AARP. We'll discuss the mission and the business of ARP. Get your tickets now by going to nprnews.org/creative economy.
Programming is supported by Alina Health, partnering with Free Bikes for Kids to collect gently used and new bikes for kids in need. Drop off your bikes October 8th between 9 and 1 at most Alina Health locations. AlinaHealth.org.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported in part by our listener members and by our generous philanthropic partners, including the U.S. Bank Foundation, making community possible for more than 150 years.
This is NPR News. Kerry Miller is off. I'm Mike Edgerly. In this hour, we're talking with Stephen Reginald. He's the editor and founder of Gear Junkie. You can join our conversation with Stephen at 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000, or toll-free 800-242-2828, 800-242-2828. Or you can go online and communicate with us via Mike Olson at nprnews.org/live. Of course, Stephen is the founder of Gear Junkie, but he's much more than that. It's not just about gear. It's about adventures and places to go, about attitude and preparation and all of that. With that in mind, let's go to Mark in Plymouth. You're on with Stephen Reginald.
Good morning. Fine show. Thanks.
Sure.
Steve, I'm interested in river skiing, the rivers of the North Shore, and something that I feel like I heard about more about 10 or 15 years ago, and I haven't really seen anything about that since. And I was wondering if you knew of any, you know, guides to, you know, sort of show us around the rivers and maybe help with rope work on the on the waterfalls or that sort of thing, or any tips to get me started on that?
Sure. Topic near and dear to me for sure. We called it rivering years ago, just as kind of this, you know, this sport unto itself. And really, for the listeners, more than 50 streams cut through the Sawtooth Mountains and kind of drop precipitously to Lake Superior. They all kind of freeze solid in the winter. There's frozen waterfalls, just these beautiful slot canyons, and then kind of wide open mouth into the Lake Superior at the end. So The challenge is, yes, start at Highway 61 or Lake Superior and work your way upstream and kind of avoid the potentially dangerous open water and climb the ice waterfalls. And so about, I don't know, 8 or 10 years ago, I did a story for the New York Times on this quote-unquote sport, and I thought, all right, I need to find something legitimate here, someone who's doing this, not just kind of this scrappy thing, and found out the UMD outdoor program led guided trips up the rivers. So got on one of those trips and did it official with a certified guide and roped up, and I believe they still do that. So I would look into UMD outdoor program, and I would add a big asterisk here at the end to say that it's a pretty dangerous activity. You're on thin ice over rushing cold water with, you know, potentially climbing vertical falls, frozen falls, and be careful. But it's exhilarating.
So just a quick scan of the equipment you would need. You would need ropes, probably crampons to get yourself up
right.
Some of these waterfalls.
Some of the rivers are really gentle, and it's essentially a cross-country ski trip.
Mm-hmm.
Other times, you're going up multi-story frozen waterfalls. You're doing sort of glacier techniques, crevasse techniques to get over open pieces of water. I remember going over snow bridges and just very thin ice on skis. So it can be extreme on one end, and then on the other side, it can be pretty just beautiful sort of cross-country skiing experience.
Right. And then coming down, are you skiing Telemark skis? What are you, edged skis?
Yep. Usually, we usually use something like a Telemark setup or just a cross-country ski setup or snowshoes, kind of depending on how steep the river is and how much snow there is. The Onion River, you can actually throw on alpine ski gear and hit some of the cascades, and it's almost like a bobsled track. So depending on the river, kind of depends on your gear, but it's a very only in Minnesota type activity for
right,
sure.
Right, right. And they're short and they're steep. There's not a lot of length to it, right?
Right. It's usually just a couple miles. And once you get kind of up over the first bump of elevation, it just sort of, most of the streams just go off into the beautiful North Shore woods, but they're not so exciting anymore.
Right. Michael Olson, what do you have for us?
We're getting some questions about snowshoeing here off the live page. One first, how do you avoid slush on lakes? And if you do encounter it, what is the best way to contend with that?
Well, it depends on where the slush is coming from. Is it coming from a spring, or is it coming because there was a recent warm spell, or is there something going on with the ice? So I don't find that much slush on lakes unless it's late season. So I don't hit it a ton, but certainly sometimes you'll hit an inflow, a tributary, or a spring where it kind of creates this bed of slush on top of a lot of ice. And how to avoid it? You just go around it. I don't know. It's usually not that big of a problem. And also you can just plow through it. It can be dangerous because you don't know, is this slush on top of a foot of ice, or is this slush on top of an inch of ice with water underneath? So it's more dangerous because it's a different kind of medium. And I would just usually try to go around it. And I would also say that it's not that big of a problem for the most part.
Go ahead. And just related to that, I have another question here about snowshoes from Colleen. Are there any new advances in snowshoes? She likes them for casual hiking, but it seems that most of the advanced ones are made for running or extreme sports, not the casual hiker.
As with anything, there's trickle down. So some of the very lightweight carbon fiber, titanium, whatever the materials are using on snowshoes for the elite now can be found on maybe more the consumer type models. However, it's a category that hasn't evolved very much. Basically, they work. They're just wide platforms for your feet. So the distinguishers are they're now lighter weight and they might be easier to take on and off, but there's been no major developments in that space that I know of.
We have another question, Stephen, coming in about winter camping. Louis likes the BWCA in summer and fall, but he's heading out for a winter trip. He's a seasoned camper, but he wants to know what tips you may have for them as they plan for a trip in the dead of winter. What should be top of mind? Obviously, staying warm, sleeping warm would be there.
It depends on what your skill level is. If you're a backpacker that does the Superior Hiking Trail, kind of has the wilderness knowledge, you can push yourself a little more in the winter. If you're a car camper, I would start at that. I would car camp in the winter. I would have your vehicle nearby before heading off Three Lakes into the Boundary Waters. So it's a bit of a tough question, but I would sort of base your first trip off what your current skills are as a camper and an outdoors person and put that into the winter environment.
Stephen Reginald, the Gear Junkie, is with us. You can join our conversation at 651-227-6000 or toll-free 800-242-2828 or online at nprnews.org/live. Let's go to the phones. Bob in North Carolina, you're on with Stephen.
Hey, good morning. Earlier caller had talked about staying warm during cooler weather camping. Well, we just came back from the Boundary Waters. I'm a native Minnesotan down here and been up there many times. And we, for the first time, took these, I think they're called Heliox backpacking cots, and they were the clear ticket. You can use them with or without your Thermarest pad. If you put your pad on, you're even that much warmer, but they're fantastic. They add a little weight to the pack, but really comfortable.
Yeah, that was a little brand that got acquired by Thermarest recently, and they are slick. They're essentially cots that roll up really small and weigh, I don't know, what do they weigh, a pound and a half? So they're usable in canoe camping or backpacking, but they give you a little cot. And by a cot, I mean you're what, 2 inches off the ground? It just gives you a little bit of height off the ground.
And if it's really cold or if it's really wet, that can be a big deal, right?
Right. I don't know about the cold. I've never used them in the cold. The wet, for sure. You get off the ground. And some people just like to be off the ground, just the feeling of a little bit of space between them and the earth.
Right. Michael, what do you have?
Heather writes in about frostbite. She got it a few years ago, and the circulation in her toes never fully returned. And her doctor is saying that she's now more susceptible to getting it again. She doesn't like using the warmers for when she's snowboarding and winter camping because it gets all lumpy and uncomfortable, and they're also somewhat unreliable. Do you have any other tips to avoid frostbite while enjoying the winter activities?
Yeah, I mean, this is a two-part question. The how to deal with it, I deal with it. I have to deal with it. I've frozen my hands and feet over the years, many times. A quick tip is, and it sounds kind of low-tech, but put your sock on, put a plastic bag over your foot, and then put another sock on. Mm. You don't get any breathability, so you're going to have sweaty feet, but just that little barrier, it increases the warmth amazingly. You might have done that biking, Mike. It's kind of a bike trick.
It's a cheap vapor barrier is what it is, right?
And then another thing is putting some Vaseline or some sort of salve on your toes really just gives you a little bit of an extra, a little layer in your epidermis where it does keep you a little warmer. So I do both those things if it's extremely cold and your feet are kind of these goopy, sweaty, appendages, but they stay a lot warmer.
Right. Well, and I think her observation about being susceptible to frostbite or pain after having experienced it, there's got to be some nerve damage in there. I know after moving here 25 years ago, I got some pretty bad, not bad frostbite, but enough. And I feel it now in my in the tips of my fingers now when I'm out riding or cross country skiing.
It's unfortunate. It stays with you. I damaged my hands maybe 15 years ago, and I do feel like now though it's going away a little bit. But it's amazing it takes that long.
Let's go back to the phones. Molly in Northfield, you're on with Stephen. Molly? Okay. Well, Molly's question was recommendations for places to get equipment. We are lucky, right? I mean, we have in Minnesota, we have outdoor retailers and online retailers throughout the state.
For sure. I mean, REI is a great shop in the national co-op chain, and there's several locations in the Twin Cities. I love Midwest Mountaineering, which is the homebred independent outdoor shop on the University of Minnesota campus. It's an amazing store. Places like Gear West or Finn Sisu, there's all sorts of shops. And also, you know, in St. Paul, there's Framed Bikes and The House. And those are kind of these outlets, or they're really pretty big outdoor retailers that are a little under the radar, but good deals on bikes and skis.
What do you have planned for your winter? Do you have, what's on your travel and outdoor adventure agenda?
I do have some new ice climbing gear. So I've been looking at dabbling back into ice climbing. I've had sort of a hiatus just with other things. And that trip with Conrad Anker we talked about earlier just kind of re-piqued my interest in it. I love winter biking, sort of. It's a love-hate thing, but right now I'm planning my sort of winter bike arsenal this year. I'm going to get a couple different bikes and try out a few things.
What kind? I mean, what are you thinking about?
Well, just kind of variations on what I ride, which is a single speed kind of urban bike, and it's just tweaking the formula. Every year I do a new build and try to make it a little bit more dialed, so that's where I'm at right now.
Mm-hmm. Any races in your future?
You know, not too many. The big thing I'm into right now is actually orienteering, which is a map and compass sport. In the fall is a big season for that. So there's several orienteering meets. MNOC.org is the website, Minnesota Orienteering Club. Highly recommend if you're an outdoors person and love to be out in the woods with a map and a compass and sort of a point to an adventure. Orienteering is a great sport for that. There's actually tonight at Como Park, there's an orienteering event. It's open to anybody. That's a big thing for me. I always encourage people to check that out.
Mm-hmm. And Gear Junkie is involved in a scavenger hunt, right? I mean, you started this a few years ago here, and now it's a national
A national scavenger hunt on October 14th, and one of the locations is the Twin Cities. So it's called Gear Drop. And if you go to Gear Junkie, you can find Gear Drop. And there's going to be a medallion hidden in the Twin Cities on October 14th with clues given. And there's going to be a $1,000 prize. So it's a big outdoor adventure. We're going to be releasing clues and you have to find the medallion.
Right.
I'm heading out to New York. We're doing a much bigger scavenger hunt out there. But it's the same premise, the Gear Drop.
Mm-hmm. Michael.
Paul is looking for a couple quick tips for fall and winter bike commuting. What do you see are the essentials?
Lights, because it's darker out, even in the morning a lot of times now. The sun doesn't come up till later, and then usually you're riding home in the dark. So lights are huge, and fenders are huge. You know, as far as accessories, the bike you use is a little dependent on what you want to do, how far you got to go, and what your budget is, but lights, fenders, and then just keeping your head and extremities warm when you're going down the road.
Right. And situational awareness. If you're on streets, right, you need to know that it's a tough day maybe for drivers as well as riders, right?
You need to shift your mentality for sure and realize that people driving are probably not expecting a cyclist at 7 p.m. on a Tuesday night in a snowstorm. So be aware of that, be more defensive, and it's also slipperier. And so my whole mentality around biking changes as the season changes, for
right,
sure.
Right. I've got to ask you about one thing, but we have just about 2 minutes left here. Buck Hill, south of the metro, is installing plastic ski slopes.
That's a crazy thing. And I haven't been down there. I actually did this years ago at a different place. And it's a weird experience, but they just went for it and they invested, I don't know, I'm assuming hundreds of thousands of dollars in installing plastic ski slopes. So you can ski year round at Buck Hill. It just opened up and it works with a silicon kind of lubricant and you use your regular winter gear and you can ski. It's crazy.
All right. Well, Stephen, thank you very much. Michael Olson, thank you for joining us. Stephen Reginald, editor and founder of GearJunkie.com. Thank you all, and we hope you have a good fall and winter.
Thanks, Mike.